The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 251, woohoo, one after 254, Friday, 29th of October, 2010. My name is Jim Race. I am here with Jules Cisek, the California boys in effect. How you doing, Jules?
Hey, how's it going?
Going very well. You know, Martin kind of sprung it on us today, but gentleman got himself a new temporary Whirly Bird. It's a real sharp ride, isn't it?
It is cool looking, isn't it?
Man, you know, you got a Ducati. You know, I've had race bikes in the past. You know, he's got a couple of nice bikes. But then he shows us something that's like a, you know, $500,000 ride. And I'm like, oh, nice.
I'm going to go fly this today.
Yeah. How fast can it go? 300. Oh, Great. Great. And you can land in the middle of the circuit. Yeah.
That's
and it'll,
right.
It'll carry your bike if you wanted to. Martin, damn you. Anyway, Martin isn't here with us this week, and so Jules and I have cobbled together what we think will still be a good show, and in fact, what we're going to try and do is bring you some stuff that you guys haven't heard that we did for a bit ago, but we'll get to that in a moment. In the meantime, some great donations this week. Somebody that I am going to term the patron saint of MotoGP OD, Alex Baverell. You guys have heard that name over and over again. Alex out of New York, a Frenchman. Once again, sent us an excellent donation and his usual pithy self. And Alex, much, much appreciated. Also, Felix Gonzalez, I believe he is a repeat contributor. Thank you, Felix. And a wonderful donation from Thomas Kelly. Awesome stuff, man. You know, I'm about just a little bit away from actually getting my own microphone with a cradle, Jewel, so you won't hear these thumps and grumps that you have to edit out. But should be pretty cool. So welcome back this week, Jules.
Yeah, thanks.
Yep. So again, I'll throw in what I'm going to do is I didn't get any fresh interviews this week, which is not surprising. I was pretty busy with work, but it's not necessarily so much that we're into the off season for some series, and trying to get people is very difficult right now, and I have to be even more persuasive than I usually am. And it's certainly nothing on the GP front, frankly, because everybody is so focused. But I have one interview that I will put together, or at least edit more cleanly, that I did with Eskil Suter back earlier, and probably another one that I'll throw in with John Ulrich. Many of you might know him as the person that brought John Hopkins to the GP scene. He's been involved on the American side, bringing racers into world championships quite often, including, you know, had an early part in Ben Spee's career, so I think those will be cool.
Excellent. Looking forward to those.
Cool. We do have Estoril coming up this weekend, and there's some news there, so you want to run through that, Jules?
Yeah, and you know, so Estoril is a track that's about 3 or 4 kilometers off the coast of Portugal. I mean, inland.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, wouldn't it? But it's a little bit, I guess, like Phillip Island, like a lot warmer at this time of year. In that it's weather can change there, you know, pretty much on a dime. And we've had a lot of years where it looked like it was going to rain, and we actually have had dry races going back as far as I can remember. At Estoril. No, actually, that's not true. 2004 is about as far back as I'm remembering, and that wasn't that that crazy race with Kenny Jr.
Yes,
and
it
Rossi.
Was.
That was and Gibernau falling out of the lead.
Yeah, and that was also a weekend. Estoril is kind of famed for having, unlike Phillip Island, having a bit of sand blow onto the track, even from being that far inland. So, yeah, it should be interesting. It'll be hard to see. I'm a weather geek. I readily admit it. I watch radar. I follow, you know, cloud formations and wind things. I'm totally into that stuff. So I have a tendency on these race weekends to kind of geek out on the meteorological side at the same time that I'm following the racing. And Estoril is kind of a tricky one to watch.
Definitely. I kind of wanted to just run through the last couple of years, just to give people an idea of what we're looking forward to, because Astrobal has always been an interesting race, not necessarily the most exciting in the last couple of years, but in 2006 was probably one of the most memorable races of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the last time that the satellite won?
It was.
In MotoGP?
It was.
It was Tony Elias on the Gresini.
But at the same time, you also had a pair of satellite guys that could have won that race.
Because we also had we had Kenny Jr. On the Team KR bike, which would have been unbelievably cool to have Kenny Roberts' team win a race. But that race was one where Kenny Roberts thought he was done and kind of rolled off the throttle. And then, oh, I had one more lap to go. That's what he's remembered for in that race. He still managed to be on the podium. And actually, Colin Edwards was within a second of the winner as well. But Elias and Rossi were 0.002 seconds apart. So that was a sick finish.
Yeah, and that if you remember, that was one of the races, much like Turkey from that same year, that Valet was a little bit, showing peevishness towards Elias's riding style, which had gotten more radical at that time and more hang-off-ish and more back-it-in.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool, though. You know, that and some say that kind of upset and made a change in the championship results at the end. Well, every race does that.
Yeah, well, Tony Elias, I think, did it to Rossi a couple of times that year.
Yeah, exactly.
And, of course, the other thing that happened that year was the unbelievably crazy thing that happened in the Repsol camp, which was, of course, Danny Pedrosa running Nicky Hayden and himself.
Are we stirring up reminders of 2006? You know, we could get this entire thing.
we don't want to – I mean, we don't necessarily spend, you know, an hour talking about it, but it does – I just wanted to kind of go through the history of Estoril because it's, you know, we're almost at the end of the season, and I'm hoping we're going to see a good race. So I'm kind of trying to go through. I went through the previous results and just kind of remember what the races were like.
Yeah.
And in 2007, we had that was the last time that Rossi won, and it was one of the few times he won in 2007 because that was the year that Casey Stoner dominated. Casey Stoner does not go particularly well at Estoril. Although I'm sure he's going to try to change that because he desperately wants to win before the end of the season. That year, I believe, was Rossi Pedrosa Stoner. And then in 2008, we had Lorenzo. In 2008, the Estoril round was round three of the MotoGP Championship, and that was the third pole position that Jorge Lorenzo had. He had Qatar and Jerez before that. And he won that race, and he won in a very, very convincing manner.
Fashion.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, very much so, very much yep. So. He stuffed Rossi in that fantastic reverse corkscrew that they have at Estoril, one of the slowest sections in MotoGP, but always really fun to watch. A guy who always goes well here is Colin Edwards. He was also excellent in that race.
Isn't that one infamous picture of Colin doing the total knee save from Estoril, where he's going around a right-hand turn, kind of started to lose the rear end, his left leg was basically pointed at the sky, and he pulled it off and stood the bike up on the exit?
I think it was actually Catalunya.
May be right.
But whatever, yeah, but that's a good memory.
I do that all the time.
And then last year, of course, Lorenzo won again, more convincingly so. And this year, I think, but prior to I guess 2006, Rossi had a fantastic long run of victories, and I think he wants to go back to winning ways this time around, especially because the championship is over now, and the only thing he can do is win.
Yeah, yeah,
you know. He did not beat Lorenzo at Phillip Island. I know I'm sure he really wanted to. So he's going to be going all out. It should be fun to watch. Looking forward to that.
No doubt. Well, especially not only that in the GP battles, because the gloves are off, but you kind of have to wonder what people's motivations are at this point and what they want to carry into the postseason. But, you know, the 125 class still well up for grabs. That's going to be a blast.
Well, yeah. So before we get to 125s, you know, what does Lorenzo want to do? He wants to prove that he can win more races before the end of the season, because he hasn't won a race in quite a while, actually. You know, Rossi's last two races on the Yamaha, Stoner's last two races on the Ducati, and Danny Pedrosa's coming back from an injury, and he's feeling pretty strong, and he's done well in this track in the past. We've got Colin Edwards, who's very good at this track, so I think we're going to see some good stuff.
I think we will, too. There is a good question about how well Danny's going to run. I mean, we saw what happened in PI, so...
Yeah, exactly. But I think that the fact that he left and decided not to race was a really smart idea, and that might actually get him to more strength. I mean, now it's been 2 weeks since PI, so...
True.
And then, you know, yeah, 125s, exactly. Marquez could wrap it up if you know, we don't have the usual Marquez, Terol, Espargaró threesome at the front. It's kind of hard to imagine them not being there. As much as Bradley Smith and Esteban and Corsi may those guys do try to be good teammates. The other three are just
always, all for themselves.
They're all out there ahead. So I don't think it's going to be quite wrapped up. I did look at last year's results in 125s. Marquez and Julian Simon had a good scrap in the front, but they both ended up crashing. I don't remember who crashed first, but I know that Simon ended up getting back on the bike, because I remember he actually even ended up scoring, I believe. Whereas Marquez crashed, and Marquez never led the race, but he was just pure pace. Looked like he was the strongest rider on the track. And that was last year. This year, he's so much stronger. So it's going to be tough for Terol and Espargaró. Espargaró was second last year, actually. So I do want to mention that.
No.
Espargaró won last year, but that was because Marquez and Julian Simon both fell.
Cool.
One
of the things that is kind of cool about Estoril is it does have a tendency, especially in the smaller ranks, to bunch the bikes up. And one of the things we've been missing for a while, and it's not necessarily due to the competitive nature of the riders bike teams, although you have to say that Marquez's Repsol bike, the combination of he and the bike certainly do have a bit of an advantage on the longer straights, is we might have the opportunity to have a bit of a tight race again, which I've been missing in the 125s of late. There's usually a very strong rabbit, at least in the waning laps. And you don't get the old, you know, and not that long ago, say last year, where you had five or six bikes battling down to the end. So I miss those races in the 125s. And how much of that might be down to whatever Moto 3 is going to be next year, I don't know. Is there a lessening of effort amongst the teams in development and work?
I really think that basically those three riders have been coming on stronger and stronger. Last year was a breakout year for Espargaró, and Terol started to kind of show up on the radar. And I think those riders really just are that much better than the rest of the field, and just the whole package that they're riding is better, because you know, Bradley Smith is one of those guys who's always up there, but he's always the bridesmaid, or like the girl that stands way on the outside of the wedding party.
But I think my observation is probably well to be at least pondered, and it's much like we had with 250 GP at the end of that year, is are the very top tier teams still on the stick as far as doing development work and putting the money into that, because that does cost real money? And are the other teams actually looking farther towards future into what they're going to be doing next year? And is there tiers of people that are doing that? And is that one of the reasons why we haven't seen these very large packs at the front of the group?
But they're not, the formula is not changing next year.
But I mean, it's okay. Sorry, not next year, but close, coming soon.
It's coming soon. Yeah, well, you know, I think you it's just like, you know, when Suzuki started preparing for the 800s, unfortunately it didn't work for them, but you know, they basically sacrificed the 2006 season and started exactly. developing the next bike. So I think you're right. I'm sure there's teams that are doing it, but with a whole year ahead and, you know, new riders coming up, I'm sure we're going to have new names, and some of these riders are going to be leaving. Some of them are going to be staying. I'm wondering, is Bradley Smith going to stay for one more year in 125s?
Yeah, he's going to Moto2. He's got to. He's completely outgrown them at this point.
I mean, I totally agree, but it seems like he should have left a while ago, like maybe last year.
I agree. I think he'll be on a 600 of some sort next year.
Got it.
But yeah, no, a fun weekend coming up. It'll be one that is in our normal European schedule that I'm actually more well adapted to than you.
I know.
I'm totally looking forward to it. You gave it. Thank you very much for the history and kind of catching us up.
One last thing about Estoril. This is very important. Daylight savings time ends in Portugal on Sunday at 2 a.m. local time, which means that check your times, because the safest thing to do, I think, MotoGP.com is going to have the correct times. They've been very good this year with providing the right times, dates, everything, days. So even if you go across a dateline, whatever. So check that and double check. The best site that I use is I'll put a link in the show notes, but timeanddate.com, spelled out, timeanddate.com. Awesome site, has all the information about the latest, you know, crazy daylight savings time. You know, everybody's got their own these days, so that's the best way to check.
Yeah, which is good, because normally, or at least up until 2 years ago, we would switch on this weekend, and we're now a week later or a week and a half later, I think. So
right.
Yep. Cool.
The complicated things even further.
Indeed.
Okay, so on to news.
A few new riders coming into the group this weekend. Actually a few, and a few that are actually going to be returning, which is cool. We do know that we've got Caparossi is going to come back and run despite his injuries that he suffered.
So he's got like half a finger and a totally messed up foot, right?
Yep. And I think also a left shoulder problem.
Man.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder, but I think at the same time, I'm just wondering how much he's getting it out for. You know, I don't know. Loyalty to Suzuki, you know, pushing towards the end, show them what you've got, or even just helping them, because they are going to need some help for next season.
I think, yeah, and, you know, he hasn't finished the race in a while either, so I'm sure he's just hungry to just cross that finish line.
Yep. And then a couple of certainly not new names that are well known to all of you folks out there in MotoGP OD land, but Carlos Checa's return to MotoGP riding on the Pramac squad, and he's certainly no stranger to Ducatis, either now in the World Superbike class or in the past with MotoGP. And we'll have to see how that goes. You know, I'd really like to see Pramac boys and maybe help Espargaró out in the last couple of races. That'd be fun.
Definitely.
Yep. We do have one I think we're all looking forward to, especially on a track, once again, much like the 125s that bunches bikes up. Kenan Safuoglu, his first appearance and maybe the first of many in Moto2. I don't know. I'm kind of looking forward to it with glee.
So what team is he riding for?
He is riding on Shoya Tomozawa's bike.
Oh, wow. That's right. Yep. Yeah.
And so certainly a mount that is capable of getting him towards the front of the races. And
but interesting, because the character of the bike is going to be perfect for him. The motor, I mean. The character of the motor.
Yeah, to some degree, maybe a little bit weaker on power. The one thing that you will have some capability of doing, because no doubt that the The very top tier world super sport bikes actually did have, through whatever magic and prestidigitation, a fair amount of adjustment that you could do to it that was still within the rules. And there's no doubt he's pretty good at setup. The question is, how much of that is translatable to the team, and will he have people coming along with him that can help basically translate what his thoughts are into changes to be made to the machinery?
Right. So yeah, it'll be cool to great wild card. So he's going to do the last two races, right?
Yep, last two races, and perhaps more from then. We really don't know what his final fate is for, or not that I've heard yet, for 2011. So we'll have to wait and see. But you have to think this is kind of a, not even dipping your toe in the water. This is pretty much diving in and seeing if the water doesn't smell bad or not.
But I'm sure he's not going back to World Superbikes.
No, I think if there's one place we will not see him anytime real soon, it's going to be in World Superbike. Just didn't seem to suit him. You and I both have a bit in here about this. The next line, and I'll let you run with that, and then I'll throw my two cents in.
You know, the final piece of the Ducati puzzle is falling into place. Burgess and the crew are going to Ducati to work with Valentino Rossi over there for 2011. You know, I mean, I don't think anybody really doubted it, but they finally just opened up and started talking about it at PI.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought it was interesting. It was first broken by an American reporter. So that was, I guess, a feather in the hat, although I thought it was somebody kind of unusual. The thing that's interesting, though, if you think about it, is Monday, post-Valencia. Okay, so day zero, if you will. What happens
to their shirts?
Well, yeah, what happens to their shirts? But even what happens on that day, test day? Well, here's what I was thinking just before we got on the call. No doubt that Jerry can step over and kind of start sussing things out. But at the same time, the actual players that are in the garages, well, Alex Briggs, who was quite the tweeter, if you will, has already said, no, we're not going to be in the Ducati garage on Monday. That either means to me that they won't be in the Yamaha garage, or they won't be in the Yamaha garage either, or they'll be there finishing out their time, perhaps warming up the new crew with House and Woody and company and Ben Spies, or kind of just hanging out and watch what's going on. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
That's a very, very good point. I didn't think about like that exact, I mean, there's a new guy coming in to Fiat. They're coming into Ducati. There's a team at Ducati that's available. I mean, is Rossi going to want to go completely with all new guys? And no, of course not. I think that there's going to be a little bit of cross pollination. You're going to have those guys kind of drifting around. It's my guess. They're going to have to get some kind of a pinkish purple shirt going, I guess.
Exactly. Well, you, yikes! Back to the '80s in AMA. You're gonna want the people that know the bike there day one, or at least some hardcore intelligence on how the bike works. And those people are going to be, well, you know.
What about Stoner's crew in that case? I mean, you know, it's going to be very interesting. I like this point. I mean,
yeah.
They're not just all gonna, you know, change outfits and go to the, you know, rotate. There's got to be some brain dumping going on.
Yep. And it, you know, I was trying to, and this is funny, and everybody out there that is not working on a team can relate. Joe, in our average jobs, if you will, you know, so a lot of times there's a transition, sometimes there's not, but usually when there isn't, there's a fair amount of time getting up to speed. And a figurative term that actually fits in here quite literally. Well, things aren't always that way in this particular situation. You know, it's like, all right, see ya, have a great time. Wrenches are over there. Sorry, we put them in backwards. it kind of makes you wonder if there's parting gifts left behind, how much information you actually get, how much data is left behind. You have to know that there is, you know, the road racing equivalent, not of NDAs necessarily, because I don't think that would ever happen. It's just too precious of knowledge not to pass on. But at the same time, although there's lots of gentlemen's agreements. At the same time, how much, you know, is left behind of your intimate secrets, especially if you're going to a competing team? It's something to think about.
Very.
Yeah. Yeah. So those of you out there in MotoGPOD land that are pondering the same thing, or at least we planted the seed in your head, feel free to talk to us about it, because I just started thinking about this afternoon and I'm like, wow, you know, when you've got all this cross-shuffling, especially of teams and whatnot, there's some interesting opportunities for bizarre little things to happen. And I really do wonder if people leave behind parting gifts.
Little Easter eggs.
Yeah, Easter eggs. What else is going on? Cal Crutchlow did hit. This is not necessarily Esterol-born, but got his first taste of the Yamaha M1 testing in Japan. And not a whole lot of news specifically about that, but he said that he was comfortable with the bike, kind of just basically in the process of fitting it to him. A point that was certainly key when James Tozen came over, and it took him probably about 4 or 5 races to get adapted to the bike physically. So we'll have to see how that goes.
So the reason why Cal Crutchlow is allowed to practice is because he is actually not a contracted rider yet. He's not until the beginning of the next season. The way the rules are stated is that, let's see. So during the season and the breaks at any circuit, with the following exceptions. So basically the practice by contracted riders, you're eligible during any of the practices, obviously, and practice during the day immediately following the Spanish Grand Prix, blah, blah, check, blah, yeah. And then during the winter, you have a maximum of 6 days. So those are the contracted riders. Now, I think basically Cal Crutchlow falls under a non-contracted rider when he was testing in Motegi. So he's basically a test rider. So he falls under the test rider rules, and there's no limit to the amount of times that a test rider can test, except there's a limit of tires. And the limit is of 240 tires per manufacturer per calendar year, which is that's an interesting way to limit it.
I do kind of vaguely remember that. I do remember that. Okay.
And there's also a rookie rider rule. Rookies are allowed an extra 3-day test in November or December. And I think that's pretty much at any track they choose to test at.
So they're pretty loose in a way. Boy, it really makes you wonder how they monitor all that, you know, the amount of tires, all of that. I bet there's a little bit of going on sometimes. Oh, look what we found that we have from last year. Or look what they slipped us on the side that might help with development.
Right. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of gentlemen's agreements and honor system type stuff and, you know, and some cheating, because there always is in racing.
I kind of was sitting there rolling my eyes just a little bit. Well, cool. The off-season stuff has always been weird, and also the mid-season stuff as well. That can be even stranger when you remember Rossi riding around the R1 and all of that stuff. So,
well, you can't stop them from riding other bikes, obviously. I mean, some of these guys, you know, will go. I mean, what they're going to actually, they should ban motocross, frankly. I mean, given the amount of people that are getting hurt in the offseason, including team
crew
managers,
yeah.
Crew chiefs, exactly. So,
no doubt. Okay, well, if you think about it, you know, Rossi actually had the R1 on a GP course.
Yeah, exactly. He was in Misano.
Well, he was at the TT
and
as
Bruneau,
well.
And Bruneau.
He was at the Isle of Man.
Oh, and he was at the Isle of Man. Good point.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Let's throw up a conspiracy theory on that one. All right. Let's lead into the Eskil Suter interview then. Good time for it.
Okay. Excellent.
Let's go.
All right. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed a great dinner there, Eskil, and good to have you back on, and thank you so much for coming back and joining us again. I got one more question for you from myself, and then I'm going to let our listeners chime in. And as I've mentioned to you before, you are more than free to to comment or not on the listener questions, because sometimes they can be rather pointed. The final question that I have for you out of my thoughts was, what lessons have you learned so far with two races in?
Yeah, what we have learned so far is that here in the Moto2, the qualifying is the half race. That means due to the fact that last time, for instance, 21 rider was in 1 second in the qualifying. That means for 1 second you cannot make many mistakes. You can understand.
Sure.
And, but when you are 21st in the qualifying, you have no chance to go in the top five. Even if you can do the same speed as the first guy in the race, you have no chance to get to the front, because the racing is so tight. That means we have to push our guys that they're going in the qualifying as fast as they can, you know, more or less crash or good qualifying. That's more or less the rule.
Yeah, the classic win it or bin it, as they say.
Exactly.
Yeah. When you were doing your initial development and testing, and this is just a follow-up to that last one, were you using a particular suspension package, or were you using, you know, Olin's K-Tech, Showa, whatever, just trying to figure out what would work best with the chassis overall?
Yeah, we have a long-term relationship with Orleans, and therefore we go with Orleans suspension. But I think it's most important is that we use the experience from the past 2 years and the chassis stiffness in braking or in torsional.
Sure. Final follow-up question from me is, as the year progresses and you find that you have improvements that can be made and or parts that are perhaps not up to the level that you feel comfortable with, nor the teams maybe, or that fail, you know, out of an analysis that could have been missed during the testing phase, how will you get those out to the teams?
Yeah, we was last time when we was testing in Mugello, we had a few new things in which I cannot really mention now.
Okay.
They're still quite secret, and we are not very satisfied with the result, but we see a clear indication that it could work out very well. But we need a little bit more testing on that items. And I hope we can bring them in mid-season, and we expect actually a big advantage from it. And again, you know, because the racing is so tight in this Moto2 class, if you can find a two-tenths of a second regularly, that will make a big step forward for our riders.
Absolutely. And I guess one last question from me, because I always have them. You were a 250 GP racer for a very, very long time, and I would have to think that you were quite a lover of two-strokes. Do you lament their demise and disappearing from the international racing scene a bit?
Yeah, sure, because, like you mentioned, we were long time racing on two-stroke, and we are kind of two-stroke enthusiasts, and that's why we are building now V4 500, a brand new engine. my brother working hard on that design to have it ready sometime this summer. And we will pack this engine in the MotoGP chassis we have more or less left over from the Ilmor project. That means we have a very modern 500 V4 two-stroke bike, which is available for some real crazy two-stroke guys and race day drivers, or just enthusiasts who like to have such a bike, you know.
And that is the perfect walk-in, because that was one of the listener questions. I've got actually a clipping here that was from your website, which is Suter's 45K Factory 500, and they wanted to know when they can get it.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, this project we have to do somehow by side whenever we have time. We cannot put 100% of our capacity behind, because otherwise it's getting too expensive. So it's hard to say. I hope that we're getting some, like I said before, sometime this summer on the track and have a first rollout with their bike. And but then we don't know exactly how long it will take until we have a development stage where we can say we can give it free to the public, because we like to make a bike ready that can be handled by not really professionals, you know. So it must be a very good level on engineering and reliability and setup, so everybody can use it. But still will be a very, very powerful bike. We aiming around 290 to 200 horsepower and a bike weight of 125 kilos, something
nice.
Like that.
Nice. Well, and just in case, if you need to do any testing on American tracks, you have my number, so please let me know.
Okay, if you pay for the shipment, we will be there.
I imagine the deposit is fairly hefty too. Okay, so that was the first of, or that was kind of in the middle of the user questions or listener questions. Another one: where it is you're working on a prototype MotoGP chassis that will house a BMW S1000RR superbike motor? Can or will you reveal anything about that yet?
Yeah, I can. It's nothing. It's no secret. Like we were talking earlier in the interview, there is a clear direction visible that the MotoGP will go into a kind of a Moto One, which allows you to use serial based engines or direction superbike, whatever.
Sure.
Then not must be serial based, so you will be free to change whatever you like. So we took a BMW engine because the outer dimensions are very similar to Honda CBR 600.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a small and compact engine, and also very, very powerful. And I don't take a superbike engine at this stage. We just take more or less a standard engine, which with a small tuning step on it, and build a new chassis, which is also again very similar to the Moto 2 bike we have now. For instance, seat frame and fuel tank and some of the parts will be almost the same. For sure, we have to build a complete new chassis. And a different swing arm with different stiffness and so on. But in general, from a few meters away, it will look like the Moto 2 bike, but it will have a 1,000cc BMW engine in there.
Nice. Yeah, I'm very impressed with the engineering that BMW was able to put together, especially on a new jump into the sport market, and actually do as well as quickly as they did. And there's a lot of people that will say, well, look at Aprilia, they did the same thing in the four-stroke sport bike market. Regardless of the RSV 1000 factory of you know, 10 or 12 years ago, but the RSV 4, and as we saw this last weekend with Biaggi taking a double, but frankly, that bike, to me, and I've said it over and over again, is nearly a MotoGP bike with mirrors. It just happens to be homologated.
Yes, for sure. The Aprilia is also a very nice, would be a very nice base, but a V4 engine will take for us a lot more engineering and higher cost than an inline 4, due to the fact that, like I mentioned before, the outer dimension are almost the same than the CBR 600. Sure. Therefore, we took the BMW engine.
Yeah.
And that's not the only thing. I also think that it's a very robust and a nice torque curve engine. So it's a good platform to start testing with and get some first impressions for the future MotoGP bike we intend to build. You know, this is like technology carrier that we can try several things and learn how the final bike has to look.
Excellent. Excellent. And I totally agree. All right, next question. Have any domestic or national series approached you or if you know of any other companies about a Moto 2 chassis supply for a spec-like series in those types of series?
It's a little bit a difficult story because most of the national championships there are supported by the importers. That means from Yamaha support, Yamaha importer or Suzuki importer or whatever, and they're getting support from there and they're running their super bikes or super stock bikes in that championship. And they are not really happy to see a Moto 2 class with a single make engine coming up in their championship. So what we are try to do is to put the initial idea there on the table to have a different makes engine. So that means we have to build a chassis which fits a Yamaha, Suzuki, Honda, or Kawasaki or Triumph engine in there. And then it could be very interesting for the national federations to put a championship together like that, you know, because then dealers, Yamaha dealer will be involved or a big Kawasaki dealer will be involved. And that's, I think, the way to go for a national championship in direction Moto 2.
Sure. And frankly, as a only semi-retired racer, I really look forward to seeing this stuff trickle down not only to the national but to the club level, because I think it will create an even bigger stepping stone into both of the premier series, which are World Superbike and MotoGP, because obviously that's where we're heading. Okay, another question that's kind of in line with the last one, but a little bit different, maybe controversial. The question is, conversely, has Infront Motorsports or the Flamini brothers approached you in any way?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. And a good straightforward answer. okay, here's a fun one for you. And I will bet you I know the answer to this. But what I want you to do is not think about necessarily current. I want you to go back within history. Who do you think was the greatest ever 250 GP rider of all time?
250. It's for me it's a bit hard to say now something because I'm a little bit too far away. I was too concentrated more on but I think Catalora was very, very fast on 250 and a great rider there. I cannot really answer the question. If you ask for MotoGP or 500, I have some answers. Problem is the 250 class is actually a step to go into the bigger class, let's say the MotoGP or the former 500 class. And there actually finally the real heroes ends up, you know.
Sure.
If someone was a very, very successful 250 rider, then he ends up in the 500 club and was also successful there, you know. So, yeah.
My guess for you was going to be Jarno Saarinen. That was what I thought you might say.
Okay.
That was just a thought. Okay. Do you still have, and I know you do, have any of your old race bikes, and if so, what are they, and which is your favorite?
Yeah, that is a little bit a shame. I don't have really much of my old race bikes. Due to the fact that you know we always got this, sponsored by the importer of Aprilia. And for sure, the budget was always a question, and so they tried to sell these bikes after the season. Mm-hmm. We have one 250 Aprilia around, which is in very nice condition as a show bike. And then what I tried to do when we built now these Kawasaki and the Petronas bikes and all these kind of things, that I have at least one of those bikes in my shop in the exhibition.
Sure.
Area. And Yeah, it's a bit a shame. For instance, the Mutz Weber from 99, I did not have one. I tried to get one now, but it's not so easy.
No, I bet. I bet. Yeah, it, you know, there's some people like, take Kenny Roberts Sr. I mean, he's got, you know, this barn full of beautiful bikes. And some people, you know, I look back at, and, you know, I was just a punter, frankly, and the bikes that I wish that I still had from back in the day. Anyway, all right. Final question from our listeners, and then a quick one from me, and then I will let you go, and I appreciate you talking to us. The final question from our listeners. What was it like working with Foggy?
Pardon, I did not catch you.
What was it like working with Foggy, Carl Fogarty?
Oh, it's Foggy. Oh, no, I understand that, but the line was a little bit bad. Yeah, it was a little bit, honestly, it was a little bit difficult. It's always difficult if two parties work on the same project, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're getting blamed because this is not correct or that is not correct, and whose mistake it is, and so on and so on. It was not not a very nice relationship with Foggy, honestly speaking.
Okay. you still have to respect him as a racer, obviously, though.
Yeah, sure. He was a very good racer, and let's say the combination or the constellation was a little bit difficult. You know, we was in Switzerland building engines. And there run the engines, and we have nothing to do on the racetrack with the mapping and so on and so on. So the borderline, who's responsibility was actually wrong in the whole project, you know.
Yeah.
So if you are responsible for the engine, we should be responsible for the engine also on the track side to make the mapping and setup. And it was really difficult because then sometime a problem appears which was actually no problem, but it was just a problem because the people don't know what the other one has done and so on and so on. So.
Sure. Yeah, distance and time and inequity in the hours available to speak to somebody always creates issues. Can I ask you, this is a question, and you don't have to answer this, but I am curious now, and maybe it's been long enough that you can answer it. What type of rear wheel horsepower you were pulling out of the Amore X3? Can you answer that?
Rear wheel horsepower, I don't know, but the engine horsepower was something around 215 horsepower.
Okay, so it was respectable enough, and especially in its early development, that if it had been brought along a little bit further, it could have certainly been up there. Do you have any thoughts still of coming back with a bike of your own build?
Yeah, it depends. If we find someone who likes to spend the money, I'm really glad to do it, you know. Or we actually would be very, very pleased to do it and show that we are able to make a bike which is, like now in the Moto 2, a kind of a winning bike. And who knows, maybe the new Moto 1 formula can give us some advantage with the 1-liter engine against the 800cc prototypes with a good rider on, and maybe we have there a good success, you know.
Very true, very true. All right. Are you having fun?
Yeah.
You're enjoying yourself still? This doesn't seem like work yet?
No, it's always, let's say, for me it's a bit a borderline, you know. I'm too much time in the office and doing some jobs which I'm not really like to do. I would like more to work on the engineering and around the bikes and those things. But you know, I have also take care about business development and meetings and all these kinds of things, and this is a little bit the hard job of it, but like you mentioned very early in the beginning of this interview, when you are on the racetrack and then one of your bike is winning, that gives you all this back and give you a lot of energy and fun, you know, to go further.
Yeah, indeed, that grin that you had in Parc Fermé, I know something like that will last you for months as far as the pleasure that it gives you that you actually pulled something off well. Do you still ride at all every so often?
I don't ride on the road. I still ride very much on the dirt bikes, motocross.
Okay.
My nephews, they're pushing me to my limit now, so I have to fight against them, and it's always very good fun, and we have a good time on a race like this.
Excellent. Well, that's about it. I really want to thank you for coming on the show, and I know it was a fair amount of work to try and get the two of us together, but I think we have a better conduit and pathway now to do so in the future, should we be able to do that. And maybe as the season progresses, we'd love to talk to you again.
Yes, I thank you also very much, and I must apologize for my bad English, let's say.
No. You've done...
And that it was so difficult to set up this interview, but we was very, very busy in the last couple of weeks, and you can imagine that it's always traveling and not in the office and so on, so it was difficult to catch me.
Sure. Well, I wish the best to you and your company and your riders right now. It looks like you're obviously, what do they call it? They say on the right foot out of the gate, and... it'd be great if you can pull off a championship this year, and I look forward to seeing what you guys come up with soon. Thanks again. I appreciate it, Eskil.
Yeah, thank you, and greetings to everybody. Yeah?
All right. You have a good night, sir. Good night.
Thanks very much, Jim, for that interview. That was a good one to pull out of the archives.
Indeed. A little bit of news on the World Superbike front. One of the people that everybody's wondering about, a bit of a fall from grace, if you will, James Toseland, wondering if he was going to have a job this year. Yes, it looks like he's going to, with the satellite squad of BMW, formed and fronted by Ayrton Badovini. So he is going to be running, and that will be kind of cool. Certainly be good to hopefully bring him back in form. There was a bit of testing being done at Aragon this week. Although I guess in the World Superbike, World Super Sports squad, I'm not quite sure all who was running. I know at least the BE1 Triumph team was running. And in fact, Lucas Scassa had live video from the, I guess from their pit box. They were running through Ustream all day on Wednesday. I missed it, unfortunately, but you might be able to catch it if they're still there tomorrow. Lucas Scassa is... Chaz Davis' new teammate on that squad. And it looks like they're really going to be pushing hard this year. In fact, there is a... I really have to wonder. I don't know how much it is, or actually if it wasn't a thought of homologation, but there is a modified Triumph Daytona 675 with stock with Olin's bits on it. So even though they're not the top-of-the-line bits, we'll have to see how that goes. But it should be pretty cool. And World Superbike, World Supersport news is getting kind of quietish these days. I think a lot of people are scheming.
Yeah, they're on vacation for sure.
Indeed. And so we'll have to see what happens.
That's pretty much it for the show. Again, remind you that check out timeanddate.com, because you don't want to mess up because of the you don't want to miss the race because of the daylight saving time ending in Portugal on Halloween.
Hello, this is Jim Reyes for MotoGP OD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing, and I am here with a man who is all about motorcycle road racing, going way, way back, and I don't want to date you, John, but John Warwick, how are you doing, John?
Doing real good.
Good.
Real good.
And we're here at Infineon Raceway, or as us old-timers like to call it, Sears Point, and it's hard to change, isn't it?
It'll always be Sears Point to me.
Indeed, indeed. And you've... When was the first time you ever raced here?
1973.
And one of the things that you do in Road Racing World magazine is you put in, what do you call it, the editor's picks or the...
Editor's scrapbook.
Yeah, and you've got some amazing photos going way back. And that may be the section that I look forward to every month, the most.
You know, it started as a one-time deal, and the response was pretty... unexpected. A lot of people liked it, so we've continued to do it. The problem I've got is that back in the early days of my career, my photo filing system was little bit less precise than it is now. So basically, I've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of boxes of Kodachrome slides that are were just tossed in boxes. So, you know, I found these things out in the warehouse one day and started rooting through them and found some interesting shots and, you know, boxes and boxes of proof sheets with negatives attached in sleeves. And, you know, picked out some of the cool ones and ran them in the magazine. The response has been pretty positive. And then a friend of mine, John Owens, another old-time shooter, had some really good shots that he sent in. He sent me some real nice black and white prints of stuff that he'd taken. So I did a couple of installments that had him as the guest shooter. But most of the stuff is either photos that I've shot over the years or somebody took of me racing over the years.
If I could ask for a wish list, you have been showing more stuff from the American side, but you've got a whole bunch of stuff from Europe that you were putting up in the beginning. More of that, please?
You know, I didn't spend a lot of time in Europe shooting, you know, so
yeah.
I was at Assen when Randy Mamola made his 500cc GP debut, so, you know, I've had some stuff from that particular race. I was actually there on assignment at the time for Cycle World magazine. I was supposed to be following around Kenny Roberts, who was going for another world championship.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up spending some time in the pits with Momola and his guys, and also with Rich Schlachter, who was over there with Kevin Cameron tuning on his bike. He was trying to race 250 GP, and then Dale Singleton was over there with the TZ500 that he had, and he was trying to race 500 GP. So I actually spent more time hanging out with those guys than I did with Roberts, because his operation, frankly, was a little more intimidating.
Yeah, old school. Okay, let's drag us back to current day, or frankly, yesterday. Today is Sunday. It's around noon. Looking at a very nice goblet over there, and you had a fantastic Saturday, or your teams did. Why don't you just walk me through what happened? Because I know you've done the double over 2 days. You did a double in one day, and I think you said that was a first for you, right?
Yeah, you know, besides doing the magazine, I've also got Team Hammer, Inc. The magazine is published by Road Racing World Publishing, Inc. We started that company about 20 years ago. We started Team Hammer about 30 years ago. And it was, you know, a friend of mine, Bruce Hammer, and I started it to go endurance racing. I'd raced the Suzuka 8-hour and came back, and I was telling them all about it. Bruce had finished second in AMA Formula One points that year, 1980. With his own TZ750, and he said something to me like, "Hey, how come you never asked me to come do some of these endurance races?" And I said, "Well, you know, if you're interested in that, we should talk about it." So we did, and he was the first guy who'd expressed interest in doing some endurance events, and was actually willing to put some money into it. So he and I put our money together. We bought a box van. He used a box van from Irv Kanemoto, and we bought a Moriwaki Formula One chassis, just like the one I'd raced in the Suzuka 8-hour. Brought it back over to the U.S., and then stuck a Suzuki GS1100 engine in it and took it endurance racing.
So I've seen pictures of that. I remember an article that you wrote where you actually broke that thing down technically, I believe.
Yeah, the editor at Cycle World at the time was a guy named Alan Girdler, and he told me I should do a story on the bike. And that was after, you know, we went to five races the first year in 81. We won three of them. So we won a four-hour. Our first win was a four-hour at Bridgehampton. Our second win was a four-hour at Road America. Both those races, it rained quite a bit during the races. And the third win we had was the annual AAMRR, maybe I don't have those initials right, AMR, annual six-hour at Loudon, New Hampshire on the old course. And that, you know, that was an interesting race for us because we, you know, the way it worked then was that, you know, I had to put in as much time at work as I could. So I would throw my wife Trudy and whichever kids we had at the time in the box van, and you know, at the last minute I would fly in to do the races. So we showed up there to race it loud. And of course, Bruce had raced there already on the AMA series. I hadn't, and we're at the riders' meeting, and they announced at the riders' meeting that the guys from California are in trouble because there are no straightaways here. And then there was a big laugh. Everyone's laughing, and I'm looking at Bruce like, "What the hell?" So, you know, we started the race, and we ended up winning by seven laps, and it was probably, you know, one of the most gratifying victories of my entire racing career because, you know, at the riders' meeting, they were making fun of us, and
basically implying they were going to kick our asses. At the end of the day, it didn't work out for them, so it was good.
All right, so back to yesterday, though, Saturday.
Yeah, so anyway, the race team has continued on through the years and, you know, went on to win a bunch of endurance titles and races, et cetera, then moved into the AMA Series. So here we are at Infineon Raceway over Sears Point. And we've got Martin Cardenas in the Daytona Sport Bike class, and he won the race on Saturday. And then we've got Elena Myers in the Super Sport class, and we're doing that as a co-effort with Richie Morris Racing. So I supplied the motorcycles or the bikes that Jason DeSalvo raced for my team last year.
Right.
And they're painted up in RMR colors and got sponsorship from Lucas Oils. And so Elena, we've been doing this Elena project. I've been working with her since she was 12. Bought her 125 one year, sent her and a mechanic out to the races, and then
back in the Kids Don't Smoke days.
Right.
Yep.
Right. Which was a program we originally started when Chris was 16 years old and racing 125.
Yep.
Anyway, so her season had been kind of tough up to this point. We took her to the first race. She had a little bit of trouble figuring out the gearing to run. So finished seventh in both those races. She was fourth running towards the flag in the second race, and guys drafted her from the chicane classic move. Took her to Fontana. She got knocked down on the starting grid of the first race and thought she broke her elbow. So that, you know, then she came back and raced the next day and got fourth. Then we went to Road Atlanta, and some guy lost his coolant on the parade lap and crashed with like four people, including her, and then her left foot was all purple.
Yeah, there were not a lot of people happy about that.
She finished fifth in that one. She just passed into fourth when red flag came out. The scoring went back a lap, and she was fifth. Then we brought her here. She, you know, all of a sudden had a bunch of pain in her left foot, got diagnosed on site here at the medical center as having a Morton's neuroma. And they said, oh, yeah, they can operate on that and only take 6 weeks to recover.
Really? I'll follow up on that later. Okay.
Anyway, so then they gave her a shot of lidocaine yesterday afternoon. That seemed to work well. So then they ended up giving her Friday afternoon, they gave her lidocaine. Then Saturday morning, they gave her a cortisone shot. Then she raced in the race. And, you know, there was a red flag and a restart. She got the restart on the front row, went with the leaders, moved up into second. Joey Pasquarello ran wide in seven. She passed him. She was in the lead going down through the S's. And Joey was right on her tail, and he high-sided himself out of the race. They were running short on time, so they called the race complete. Backed it up a lap when Pasquarello was in first. Elena was in second. But as per the procedure for red flag, they put Pasquarello at the end of the lead lap, so
yep.
Gave Elena the win. But, you know, and some people say, oh, well, you know, the guy crashed. Yeah, well, he crashed when he was in second. She passed him before that, so, you know.
Exactly.
My mind's a legitimate win.
Yeah.
She did good. First woman to win an AMA pro road race event, sprint event. And it was great.
It was, and not to even use a joking term, the atmosphere after that was electric around here. People were so excited. In the press room, I couldn't believe it. It was packed full, and you don't really see that for a super sport so much these days. So, a fantastic win for her. It was cute because she's taking time to kind of grow into herself, but she's still a little shy, and especially when all the attention is focused on her. I saw her yesterday, she didn't quite know what to do.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
It was great. I mean, she's a real racer, though. You know, when I've been watching her at the events this year, and I watch her when she's in qualifying, she comes in to check the monitor and then goes back out. Man, she's got a race face.
You know, she
is deadly serious about this. She wants to make this a career. And, you know, I've been looking for, you know, 25 or 30 years for the girl, you know.
Yeah.
And got involved with some other girls, different, you know, helped them with their racing and stuff, and none of them really got it done as a racer. But this one was different. There was something about her when I met her. And my friend Susan Warren, who used to co-own Arclight Racing, they sponsored Elena when she was like eight or something. She told me one time about her. Then, as you know, fate would have it, Arclight went out of business about the time Elena was 12, and her dad called me up and said that he wanted to come down and see me and get some career advice. And he brought her down and beat me in my office, and she came striding in and stuck out her hand and said, "Hi, I'm Elena Myers," and had a pretty firm handshake, and I'm looking at her and thinking, man, this, you know, she's brimming with confidence for being a 12-year-old.
There's a lot of good kids that have come out of Stockton. I mean, that place has seemed to breeds some pretty sure,
isn't,
strong
isn't,
racers.
Isn't Fong from Stockton?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, anyway, so
yeah, Cam too.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, starting them when they're little on little bikes on go kart tracks can't possibly hurt.
Yep.
But yeah, anyway, you know, I decided, you know, then to help Elena, and kind of drew up a master plan that included taking her to Daytona when she turned 16, and that's basically what we did.
Yeah, and she was right over the edge. All right, so congrats to Elena, and very, very happy, and we'll have to see what happens today. She was 8th, I think, in warm-up today, a little bit off the time. She was gridded 8th yesterday, I think, too?
That's right.
Okay. Warm-up was a fair amount slower than it was yesterday, but it was a little bit chillier. Martin, another successful day.
Well, yeah, it's funny. We got hooked up with Martin here. It was about 3.5 years ago, I think. And
yeah.
Michael Barnes crashed in the FX race on Saturday, broke his wrist. We were looking for somebody to ride the Supersport bike on Sunday. My son Chris had been telling me about Martin. You know, from seeing him on the track, he came in and said, "Man, that guy's got some skill, but his bike is junk." And he was over here riding a friend of, you know, some bikes that some friends of his gave him to ride. He started with a ZX10, which was trying to kill him. Then he was here racing a ZX6 that looked almost stock to me. Looked like it had a pipe on it. And he qualified 20th. I went walking over to him and said, "Hey, you know, you want to ride my bike tomorrow?" He said, "Yeah, sure." "You know, do you have any contractual obligations that prevent you from doing that?" "No, no." So, you know, took him down, had him sit on the bike. Guys adjusted the controls. He drew up a one-day contract for Sunday. He signed it. Started 20th, was in 12th place and going for 10th by what I could see when the race was red flagged. That was pretty good. Asked him if he wanted to go to Road America a week or two later. He said, "Yeah." Drew up a week-long contract for that. Last lap of the FX race at Road America, he passed Alex Gobert for third, turned the fastest lap of the race, was on the box, and I thought, okay, we got something here.
Yep.
And the rest is history.
Okay. All right, and so we also know that you've had John Hopkins back this year, but we also know about the injury to his left wrist, I think it is?
Right wrist.
Right wrist. He's had that mostly taken care of at this point. When do you expect him back?
You know, theoretically, best case, he could be back at Laguna Seca.
Okay.
You know, that was an interesting thing, too, because I was sitting at my desk. This is way late. It's almost the end of 2009. I got this phone call from Bob Moore, who was Hopkins' agent. Of course, Hopkins started riding for me when he was 15, won a couple AMA championships with us. He started his pro career with my team, and then he had this opportunity to go off and race 500 GP, and I told him, "Look, you know, you have to take it. I mean, you can stay here in the U.S. and learn how to ride a superbike at Pikes Peak, or you can go over there, race YZR 500s, the best bikes on the best tracks against the best guys, and live your dream," because his dream was to get to 500
sure.
GP. You know, he's a little nervous about it, and I said, "Look, you got to go. If it doesn't work out, you can come back. I'll have a bike for you. It'll be fine."
You never thought it'd be that long, though.
No, you know, so 8 years later, here's this agent calling me up saying, "Hey, did you tell Hopkins that if you wanted to come back, you'd have a bike for him?" I said, "Well, yes, I did. Why?" He says, "Well, he wants to come back and race in the U.S. I say, "Okay, what's he want to race?" "Superbike." "Okay, how are we going to pay for that?" "Well, Kawasaki's going to quit road racing, and we think we can get some monster money to come with him." It's like, okay, let's do that. So, you know, and when he showed up, first time to ride one of our bikes, we took him to a track day at Fontana. He had never seen the infield of Auto Club Speedway. It wasn't built when he left for Europe.
Yeah.
And, you know, he came walking to the garage grinning, happy to be there, just like when he was 16. He used to come walking under our tent at the races, and, you know, it was all good. Unfortunately, he had a wrist problem, which was worse. I didn't know anything about it.
Okay.
You know, he believed that it was fixed because he'd had surgery in November to have a bunch of stuff fixed, and the doctors told him it was going to be all good. It wasn't all good. I didn't know how bad it was till we got to the second race of the series at Auto Club Speedway, and we basically had about 15 degrees of wrist rotation, or wrist movement.
Sure, yeah.
Anyway, it was, then he had some Roto-Rooter work done on it before the race at Atlanta. Still was having problems, but in the second race at Atlanta, he was, you know, he's the fastest guy on the track. So
yeah.
For him to do that, given his wrist problems, was pretty phenomenal. And then we found out he had to have a complete wrist reconstruction. So,
yeah.
You know, now he's out until at least Laguna.
You got a great replacement rider.
Yeah, Jake Holden jumped on the bike, went pretty well. He also wrote the bike off at the end of the qualifying session. It happens. You can't be too attached to race bikes. You know, you get your heart broken. So, You know, he kind of missed on the setup yesterday. I told him, I said, look, man, just, you know, do your thing, finish the races. You know, he hasn't got a lot of time on a Suzuki GSXR 1000 in, you know, last couple of, I don't know, 3 years or something.
Yeah.
The bike's changed from last time he rode one. I said, look, you know, you get used to it this weekend, we'll go to the next place, you'll be more used to it, we'll go to the next place, you'll be more used to it. You know, what we need is we need him to finish solidly in the top 10. If we can get in the top 5, that's great. Anything beyond that's the icing on the cake. So, you know, that's my attitude on this deal. He's doing a great job so far, easy to work with.
Absolutely.
As soon as the guys get the setup working, you know, as soon as they get the setup exactly right for him, what he needs, he's going to be good.
So the last time that I saw you at an AMA race, because we ran into each other at Miller last year as well, but was here, and it was a little bit quietish, and there was kind of a in the air. To me, right now, this place feels totally different. There is a buzz, and it seems like it's coming back, and a lot of that is probably down to David McGrath, I think.
Yeah, I mean, look, you got a guy in McGrath who's done the privateer gig out of his van. I mean, when I met him, he was a privateer racing mules and sleeping in his van.
Yep.
So, you know, then he went on to, you know, work on a factory team and be a factory team crew chief with Curtis Roberts and AMA Superbike, and then he went off to work for Buell, and he's got an understanding of what it's like to be working out of your van in the back of the paddock and working out of the semi-truck with the, you know, factory team, et cetera, et cetera. And what's been lacking in the past is, and I've always said this to whoever's been running AMA Pro Racing at the time, I said, look, if you take care of the guys in the vans, the guys with the semi-trucks are going to be fine. The opposite is not necessarily true. We need to take care of the guys in the vans, which, you know, people thought I was crazy. McGrath gets it. The other thing is, because he's ridden enough that he understands fair is fair.
Yeah.
Okay? And you can argue, you know, phrases and rule books all you want. Americans have a pretty well-developed sense of fairness. We know fairness when we see it. Now, the officiating...
When is a jump really a jump, right?
Yeah. I mean, when, you know, what we saw going on last year was not fair. It was crazy. Their stuff was being changed for no reason. Problems that didn't exist were being solved. You know, I mean, it was insane. So what we've got now is we've got a return to common sense. Are they going to make a few mistakes? Sure, they'll make a few mistakes. That's part of the human condition. But the bottom line is these guys get it. They're trying hard to be fair and reasonable. The series has turned a corner. The guys who were screwing everything up have all been fired.
Bye-bye.
And, you know, guys in the paddock can see the difference, feel the difference, and it's a whole new day. So I got high hopes that this thing, you know, is on the right... It's pointing in the right direction. It's going to continue going that way.
And there are a lot of fans here today.
Sure.
This place is buzzing.
Sure.
I mean, I'm very impressed. Right. I know that I've taken way up too much more of your time, but, John, thank you very much for coming on the show. You and I talk incessantly all the time over the net, but first time we've had you on, we'll hope you have on again. And best of luck this afternoon.
Thanks. Hopefully it'll all be good. In the meantime, you know, if anybody wants to check out RoadRacingWorld.com or Road Racing World Magazine, check it out. It's good. If you like it, if you're listening to this show, you'll probably love the magazine. And hope to see you all at the races.
Awesome. Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
That's it for the show. We're in the Bay Area. We're kind of excited because there's a weird sport involving a ball and a stick that's
not called cricket.
Yes, not called cricket. That a local team is one of a very big game today, and the beginning of the World Series. Giants, yay! Fear the beard.
Woo-hoo. Yeah, that was pretty cool. That's everybody over on the other side of the pond and beyond is like,
whatever.
Yeah,
it's the World Series though. The world, you know, it's the whole world.
There's
Canada and United States. Anyway. you're adding that awesome Mark Miller video that he was talking about in his last interview. Some of his archive tapes of VHS stuff that he's posted to YouTube, which has a clip from this an amazing AMA round that I remember reading about, but I've never seen. So it was really fantastic to see.
Yeah, it actually opened up some interesting questions and stuff to talk about Mark with later because. Anyway, the particular race is 1993 at PIR, Phoenix International Raceway. It was kind of his dawning of a new era, if you will, into going from this was early days, from an amateur into the AMA hardcore, and the years after that were some of his more hardcore and very serious ones where he was moving up through the ranks. But I also found out that, about, and I'd never put two and two together, one of the most infamous bikes that he was riding back in the day, which was the legendary R7/R1 Franken bike that was world renowned. And so we'll hopefully talk about that.
That was also the bike that Haga rode in 98.
Indeed. And so it all kind of came out of that exact little bit of area from Attack Racing and moving on out. So that's a story we all definitely want to hear. Anyway, once again, one convoluted podcast brought to you by ours truly. hope you guys kept up. I hope we kept up. I don't think we did, but we'll give it a shot always. And we will talk to you soon. Once again, talk to us and chat with us live on the Facebook fan page for MotoGP OD. And you can also reach us by email through the contact form or however else you would like to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So very cool. Thanks very much for listening, downloading the show, and we'll talk to you next week.
Ciao.
Ciao.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them.
I'm going to now give you the exact rules, and what we'll do is we'll take that bit out because I think it's better that we actually know what the fuck we're talking about.